This is Casey Current. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Poet, activist, one of the architects of Black Studies programs at universities. These are some of the many facets of Sonia Sanchez. In the late 60s and 70s, her poetry reverberated the themes of reclaiming Black identity and self-determination. Sanchez has been called one of the most important writers of the Black arts movement. At 77, she still lectures internationally on Black culture and literature, women's liberation, peace, and racial justice. Sonia Sanchez was recently invited to Kansas City by UMKC's Black Studies Department. I interviewed her about her life and career in front of an audience at UMKC 2 weeks ago, just before her reading. Let's start at the beginning. You were born in Birmingham and really coped with tragedy and displacement in your life, and I think it's a testimony of how people can channel pain into beautiful art. How did those experiences really affect you and influence you to be a writer?
Well, I'm not too sure that it is the pain that has propelled me as a writer. I think that it probably has been the beauty of someone like my grandmother in a place called Birmingham, Alabama, the memories of aunts in the house, the memories of me as a child running, I guess in a sense, wildly wild in Birmingham, Alabama. I ran with the boys, which meant that they ran. You got up in the morning and they were out all day long running, climbing trees and getting in trouble. And that's what I did, and my grandmother let me do that. I had a sister who was just beautiful. I mean, she was drippingly beautiful, you know. My sister would wake up in the morning, everybody would pat, you know, whatever, you know. And she didn't have to do anything except show up, right? She'd go outside to play. And you know how they used to dress you in these cute little dresses and stuff, right? And, you know, the pigtails and the ribbons and stuff. And my sister would go out and play, and at the end of the day, she came back looking the same way. And I used to say to her, "What do you do outside?" I knew she didn't play. It's very hard being beautiful, people, you know. Make no mistake about it. You know, it's a hard job. And I came back in with pigtails out and dress torn. And my aunts, you know, it was a house of women, my grandmother, mama. And they were really first cousins, but they were older. So we called them aunt, you know, our Aunt Ruth. And they would just cluck their tongues and say, this child just ain't going to grow up to be a lady. And there was some good in that, you know. I have those great memories. I have those memories also of one of my aunts taking me on a bus to work with her. And, you know, in those days, you got on buses and you sat in the back, right? Black folks did. And then the bus got full. It was a bus going to work. People were going to work. And so the bus driver said, "Get up." And so we stood up. And then it got so crowded, we had to, like, you know, really, you know, move kind of forward. And then the bus driver, it got full. The bus driver said to the blacks, "Then get off the bus," so whites could stand up. And my Aunt Pauline refused. And I remember being little, looking up like this at all the activity. And the bus driver said something, "If you don't get off, I'm going to stop this bus and do whatever." And he stopped the bus and got ready to grab her, and she spit in his face. And I remember that they took us off, and we went to jail, and the family came. And I remember feeling little, looking up at her in a different way. But I know that because my dad was a school teacher, a man who owned a juke joint, and was one of the first black jazz musicians, that I know they got her out of town that night. That's the South. But I remember, you know, I remember that incident, and I wrote about it.
And I understand started writing then at a young age.
Right, mm-hmm. I did. I used to write these little ditties, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, what that's about. They halfway knew that I wrote, but I really did not, they didn't really discover my writing until my dad brought us to New York when I was 8 years of age, brought us to Harlem. You know, I would write and hide my stuff. You know, so no, you know, I had my notebooks, and people call them journals now, right? You know, but I would hide them. And because I took care, my job on Saturdays was to clean the kitchen and the bathroom. And we had those old fashioned tubs that you pay a lot of money for now as antiques, you know, right? I would hide them underneath the tub. And as my dad said to me before he died, he said, I don't know what really what happened to you, Sonia, because you were such a quiet child.
You participated in a writer's workshop in Greenwich Village, and there were all kinds of luminaries in the Black Arts Movement.
Yeah, the scholar who wrote that got it wrong. After I graduated from Hunter, and I was waiting to teach, right? I went back to school, went to grad school. In the midst of going to grad school, I looked at the catalog because I wanted to take a writing class, right? And lo and behold, there was a creative writing class, poetry class, taught by a woman by the name of Louise Bogan. For you writers here, one of the most important American poets, you know, here. She was teaching at NYU. But I had all kinds of difficulty of going into workshops, being one, the only female, you got to hear this, you know, and the only Black. And I raised my hand to say something and completely ignored. So after about two sessions, I would leave. So I'm here, I haven't registered, I'm sitting by the door, and it's a class of 45 people, right? And I'm looking around. There were three women in a class of 45. And I was the only Black. So I'm looking at this woman, Louise Bogan. She's the poetry editor of The New Yorker. I read her work, and I said, let's see what the deal is here, right? So she said, the first night she talked about what we were going to do. And then she said, does anyone have a poem? No, does anyone have a poem here? That's like asking an alcoholic, you know, if he or she has a bottle in the house, people, you know, whatever. We all pulled our poems out of pockets, jackets, purses, whatever, briefcases, whatever. And I raised my hand and said, you might as well find out the deal now. So I raised my hand, went up front and read the poem. And everybody raised a hand to respond to it. I said, I'm going to stay. You know, and I stayed there for 1 year. The thing that Bogan did, which I did, I mean, everything I learned in that class over the years, right, with her, I taught in the same. But first of all, she taught us form. She said, you might write vers libre, she said, but you better know form, whatever. So, and we moaned in that workshop. I can still hear my moan, right, you know? We moaned in that workshop, but we understood foundly at some point that you had to understand there was form involved with free verse. And then the other thing, she taught us also how to send work out. She sent us to the 8th Street bookstore to find out the kind of poetry that would fit into some of these places, you know, some of the journals like the Transatlantic, the Paris Review, all these reviews, right? And then she said, send no more than three poems, whatever. So I did a notebook of about 15 pages, the different places, you know, to send work out. And I was telling that very nice English class, creative writing class I went to this morning, that I sent the poem out. The first time I sent a bunch of them out, about five, and by the time I got home, it had been returned, right, you know? And with the thing, the editors, right? The good thing is that Bogan kept saying, send your work out. You're going to find out some things. And it was in that class, during that time, my dear sister, that I got a poem published, two poems published in the Transatlantic Review, you know? And at that time, I got a letter back from George Garrett, who said, your poetry also would have been in this issue, except we just had so many poems, you know, whatever. Send us some more poetry. But to make a long story short, I brought bottles of wine into NYU, right? Because Bogan drank, you know, I mean, she was a drinker. So we got in with cups and whatever, and we celebrated being published there in that workshop. I was the only one in that class who did get published. And from that group, I can't think of the brother's name now, he said, you, 10 of us, let's meet in the village. And let's continue the workshop after that year. And so we met on Charles Street. We met about 2 years, and during that time, the next year, I began to publish, you know, and it got tricky. And I always tell people, you know, workshop, you got to know when to get out, because it got to be tricky that I was the only one publishing in that workshop, and that got to be really tricky in that I stopped saying I published.
Now, you joined the Nation of Islam. What led you to join, and then when you found out that you were facing oppression from your own, did that shock you and surprise you, and what did you end up doing about it?
Well, no, what happened? You have to understand that most of the writers we knew had embraced some kind of Islam, from Baraka to Askia. I mean, they all people changed their names. They took Islamic names. Most of the people I knew were looking at a man by the name of Malcolm, right? And what that meant to them was the kind of change about that. Most of the people I knew also at some point looked around and said that one of the most progressive things that they saw happening in America was at that time the nation in terms of schooling the children, in terms of politics, in terms of buying land, in terms of owning land, in terms of owning property, whatever, and owning bookstores, whatever. So that's why a lot of people gravitated towards that at that particular time. What happened to many of us also, too, is that it was a place for a lot of women for protection. See, people forget that many of us were out there on our own, and we were challenging a place called America. And some people had been killed, some people went to jail, and many people really at some point needed an anchor of sorts. And so the nation was an anchor for me on many levels, where I was able to see my children, you know, go to school, have a place, whatever. And then at some point, you felt some kind of protection, because once you went into the nation, there was protection. One of the most fascinating things that I did in the nation, however, was I had a column. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but I made a place for children to write their work. I go all the way around the world to this day. Around the world, people walk up to me and say, you chose a poem of mine in Muhammad Speaks. In fact, it was a bone of contention in the nation. They said, how could I have a full center page? That's what I had. Children's work and then women's, whatever. So people wrote. So I wrote, you know, and I wrote about all issues, and probably that's how I got in trouble. You see, you don't let people limit you wherever you go. And my point was that wherever I was in New York Core in Black Studies, because people tried to limit you in Black Studies also too, or in the nation, right? I said, I can't, you're not going to limit me, because there's something that goes on in organizations when people see you as an artist that it bothers them, you know, like no one really trusts the artist. You know, they think the artist is always subversive, and that's true, you know.
So, of course, you've received so many awards, accolades for such a prolific career, but what are you proudest of? What do you see as your main legacy?
Whew. I don't think you end up with just one legacy. You know, I travel around a lot, university. I see former students. I see one here that's a couple other former students here that I've seen. I even see, you know, and they're professors, you know, and I know they're continuing that great tradition. There's no one legacy. I mean, if one has got to zero it down to one thing, it's that I walked upright as a human being. And along the way, I taught. Along the way, I had children that I'm very proud of. Along the way, I met people that I have loved.
Now, we're getting to the end of our time. Two mm-hmm. questions that mm-hmm. I have to ask you, and mm-hmm. one is, you mentioned your founding of Black Studies. Mm-hmm. First of all, how did you convince the university to do a Black Studies program, and mm-hmm. how do you think, as you look at ethnic studies programs now, how do you think the challenges now are even different?
Well, I mean, I wasn't the originator of it. The great thing about Black Studies is that it came from students. You know, I will never forget. I keep telling people that this movement that is going on now with people, you know, who are sitting in, you know, the occupiers now, a very important movement. You know, you don't kick them. You got to go. And I was up at Yale, right? I was on the bus being taken back to a hotel, and I said to the bus driver, can you tell me where the occupiers are here, you know, here? And he said, oh, right down the street in the park. So I said, well, can you drop me off? And he said a very interesting thing. He said, Professor Sanchez, I will drop you off, but I will wait for you. And so he said, the rest of the people should get off too. And when he dropped, but most of them didn't. But that brother, who was a worker, you know, said, we will wait. And we had to jump a fence to get to it. You know, you see how tall I am, you know. And we went and we hugged them and thanked them and talked about that they were part of a long American tradition of resistance. Always resist, you know, in this place called America, right? And always bring up that which is incorrect in America, period. You got to do it. And that's why we're here. you know, always helping you at some point to answer the question that we started answering in the 20th century, and now we're in the 21st century. What does it mean to be human? That's what this was all about. That's why we started making the university human, making it less elitist, bringing in people who were poor, you know, people who were Black, Latino, people who were Asian, you know, people who were Native Americans, you know. That's we open up our class to students who were gay and lesbian, you know, and say, hey, everybody comes in this classroom. You got to hear that. You got to understand that. And there was a lot of, you know, flack as a consequence of that because people have very distinct, you know, attitudes. But, you know, we did that. And all of that came from this woman, Mama, you know, who really allowed me to be kind of like, you know, she let me run and be what I wanted to be. And she didn't hold me to the standards of my sister or the aunts in the house. And I am, in, you know, forever indebted to her, you know, for that.
That was poet, scholar, and activist Sonia Sanchez. Sanchez is professor emeritus at Temple University and was recently named Poet Laureate of Philadelphia. This conversation was recorded at UMKC. Hear the entire unedited version at kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, don't worry. All our shows are archived on our website, kcur.org. And we have a podcast. Find us on iTunes.